Hello and welcome to Away 21 Years on Air here on RN, Daniel Browning with you. Today we drop in on a new exhibition. It's a survey of a 20-year artistic practice and a lifetime's worth of activism. Richard Bell's Lessons on Etiquette and Manners includes some of his most provocative statements, his mural with the former Black Panther Emery Douglas, and an installation that reimagines the 1972 Aboriginal Tent Embassy.
What are we fighting for?
Justice.
I'm telling our stories and I'm legitimising our stories as being just as important as from any other part of the country.
And we hear about the Melbourne-based Music Outback Foundation, which has been delivering workshops in remote communities in the Northern Territory, the far north of South Australia and western New South Wales.
It's a fantastic opportunity for communities to see their young people performing and demonstrating, showcasing their skills. And it does do a lot for the kids' self-esteem, but it also, you see the elders sitting there with some pride, seeing the people from their community acquiring skills through the process.
Stay with me, that's all coming up here on Away.
I will make oppression work for me, with a turn and with a twist, be camouflaged with instated ignorance, then rise, as a prize you by my will. I will make oppression work for me, with a turn and with a twist, I shall sit cross-legged like a trapdoor, then rise, as a prize you by my will. I will let you pass me over, believe me stupid and ill-informed. Then once you believe me gone, all control will rise and surprise you by my will. Poverty isn't an Indigenous condition. You know, it's a condition of our Western society. And even then, when you have no money, are you truly impoverished? Unless you believe that. But, you know, if we are without money and don't have our community structure set up where we can support each other through that time, then, yeah, we're going to be very poor and believe ourselves poor. That becomes a state of the will and a state of the spirit as much as a socioeconomic identifier.
I have witnessed the falling of many, heard them cry and hear them still. But even with grief inside me growing, I command my spirit to rise and surprise you by my will. And for all people, we are here, and we are many, and we shall surprise you by our will. We shall rise from this place where you expect to keep us down, and we shall surprise you by our will. For the bullets we dodged, they were difficult. And this ideological warfare, it is more difficult still. And even now, as we challenge inhumanity, we shall rise and surprise you by our will.
The poet, philosopher and filmmaker Dr. Romaine Morton reading her poem I Shall Surprise You By My Will and sharing her deep thoughts on the psychology of poverty with Away's Lorena Allam in 2004. And this is Away. We've been 21 years on air here on RN. Now, let's get this straight. Richard Bell doesn't make Aboriginal art, but he does make art about being Aboriginal, like his colleagues in the Brisbane-based artists collective Proper Now. A new survey at the Monash University Museum of Art, MUMA, is the first in-depth exhibition of his work ever to be staged in Melbourne. And it includes some of his most provocative statements, like the one that proposed that Aboriginal art was a white thing and that Australian art is an Aboriginal thing. The centrepiece of the exhibition is his mural with the former Minister for Culture in the Black Panther Party, the artist Emery Douglas. The new work, commissioned just for this show, is an installation which reimagines the 1972 Aboriginal Tent Embassy in Canberra. But instead of a beach umbrella and four blackfellas, it's banana lounges, astroturf, and an esky filled with imported Italian beer. The exhibition, co-curated by Max Delaney and Francis E. Parker, was opened by the activist and historian Gary Foley, who also appears in two of Richard's films, Broken English and Scratch an Aussie. But why is the exhibition called Lessons on Etiquette and Manners? Here's Richard Bell.
I was asked for a title, for the show. I was a little bemused by that. I thought about it for a moment, and then the first thing that came to my head was lessons in etiquette and manners, you know, because in actual fact, you know, these people need to understand, you know, what etiquette and manners are. You know, they came here uninvited, you know, like, have overstayed their welcome for well over two centuries. You know, I just thought it would be a great title for an exhibition.
We're in the room where, I guess, it, you know, in terms of your career, this is where it all begins. In this room, there is the famous, the image of the stat deck, and a certificate of authenticity from the Darwinian Society. But I want to look over at this work over here, because this one has always fascinated me.
This is like a poster for a course for, shall we say, assimilationists among Aboriginal people. This was a course at a made-up university, you know, the University of Fulgunamiglu Society. Blackfellas know what that means. I think it was about the time of just before Mabo, and there was this emergence of a lot of blackfellas who had kind of assimilationist ideas and ideals. And I thought, well, maybe I'll develop a course for them where they can go to.
And it's an Aboriginal degree in decolonisation. What do you think? I mean, since you painted this painting, of course, Mabo decision, but there has been a rise in conservative Aboriginal politics. Well, the voice of conservative Aboriginal people seems to have been amplified.
Well, they should have run this course. I did something similar when I was living in Sydney. There was this field officer training course at the University of New South Wales where we did a lot of stuff. That course, you know, has formed the basis of, you know, the research for my career, you know, my artistic career. So,
you were trained as a field officer for the Aboriginal Legal Service?
Yes. Yeah.
So what kind of things were you being trained in?
Oh, well, we were taught to speak publicly. We were doing pleas for, you know, like minor cases, making bail applications and things like that. We're taught how to deal with the media. That came in handy for me, you know. And we were taught how to present the Aboriginal messages positively, so hopefully that's what I've done in my art career.
Dirty.
Clean.
Shiftless.
Moving.
Reserves.
No good.
Centrelink.
Worse.
Black.
Good.
You tell a story about, you know, I think you were making tourist art.
Yeah, yeah.
But someone told you that there was more money to be made in fine art.
Yeah, well, what interested me most was that I could get to more people, you know, and I could say and do things, you know, without getting arrested, you know, that was very attractive to me, you know, like, so a lot of the stuff I've gotten away with, you know, I might have been arrested outside the art world.
I mean, in a sense, this is a retrospective. You're very much alive and well, but this is a survey of your career, and we're in the very first room. Are you proud of the work sitting alongside, you know, the much more sophisticated work that you've produced in the last few years?
Yeah, well...
Because some people might not want the first work to appear in an exhibition like this.
I'm a kind of warts and all guy. That's how I am, you know. So what if I cringe, you know, people want to see, you know, where it came from, you know, and these sorts of things. So, you know, these works, you know, were from that earlier period. This work here was, I had a break from art making between 1995 and 2001, you know, and this was one of the works that I made in my comeback. This was probably where that level of sophistication that you were alluding to began. So, it's a It's a work called Worth Exploring. You look, and there's some issues here in the statutory declaration, you know, which are quite provocative, and it gets people thinking. You know, like I've heard people, oh, he's got to be joking, you know, or he's kidding himself, blah blah blah. And, but I'm asking the questions. You know, I want some answers. Yeah.
And the statutory declaration, it says that everything that's happened since invasion is subject to question.
Indeed, that's exactly
the legitimacy of everything is questioned.
Yes, yes, exactly. You're like, let's have a discussion. You know? We just keep running away from any kind of discussion about these issues. You know? I want to see things get better. You know? Like, I think this country has an opportunity to be something really special. You know, to show the rest of the world this is how you deal with things, you know, like deal with problems, you know, deep-seated problems. You know, like, I'm Aboriginal, I know how to wait. You know, these things take time, you know, like it might take 100 years, you know, for us, you know, to get around to having this discussion, you know. Like, it's never too late, I don't think.
Let's move into the next room. And here on the wall over here, we've got the work that's considered a signature.
Yeah, well, this is Scientia Metaphysica. This is what I won the National Aboriginal Art Award with. I painted it to win the thing. I started a rumour, you know, the weekend before it was judged that I'd already won it. You know, so.
And, of course, its provocation is that Aboriginal art is a white thing. And you still, I mean, I've heard you defend that, the argument that you make with this work. I've heard you defend it very recently. You still feel the same way?
Oh, look, nothing's changed. You know, it's 10 years ago that I painted this painting. You know, not a lot has changed. You know, like they've just changed the wrapping, you know, with the product. Still the same. Then I stopped making works like this. I didn't do anything like that until 2006 when I did this one. I sent an image of this as a work in progress to the Museum and Art Galleries of the Northern Territory as an entry for the Telstra Prize that year. And they knocked it back, and the reason they knocked it back is that, oh, well, it's too much. It's exactly the same as the other one.
It's not. I mean, it says something completely different.
But, you know, like they said the process was exactly the same. Well, hello, what about bark painting? What about dot painting? It was quite ridiculous. So this is called Telstra painting. And the text on this says, Australian art, it's an Aboriginal thing. Those statements are true. You know, Aboriginal art, it's a white thing, and Australian art, it's an Aboriginal thing. So.
With this, are you saying that Aboriginal art is what is equals Australian art? Is Aboriginal art the sum total of what's distinctive about Australian art?
Well, you go overseas and ask what is Australian art, and they'll point directly and straight at Aboriginal art.
So it's proved.
It's true.
Mm. Yeah. But you also say that you don't make Aboriginal art.
No, I don't. Oh, I don't make Aboriginal art. I make contemporary art. You know, us East Coast blacks aren't allowed to make Aboriginal art. You know, like that's a fact. You know, if we started doing dots and that, you know, like we'd be accused of ripping off the desert artists. But, you know, like there's lots of examples of where white people do it and they get celebrated.
What are we fighting for?
Justice. Justice.
Brotherhood, sisterhood, and caring and sharing.
You get nothing, you're taken nowhere. If you want something, you go get it yourself.
What are we fighting for?
I'll get shot.
Don't be shy. Turn these lights off, you won't be shy.
Yeah, you can't see me then.
Still fighting for a bit of everything, eh?
Just to be accepted.
What are we fighting for? Try and get our tradition back. They try to take everything away from us, you know?
Non-Aboriginal people have everything and we have nothing. And all of us are struggling. Is in itself what it's all about.
Okay, right. What are we fighting for?
Land rights.
Land rights, self-determination, economic independence, It's as simple as that.
We've gone beyond getting angry or frustrated about it because we reckon, you know, we start getting frustrated and angry, we'll be as stupid or as ludicrous as them.
In the long term, we either get justice or the genocide will be complete.
From the film Broken English by Richard Bell and featuring Gary Foley. And I'm with Richard Bell at the first in-depth exhibition of his work in Melbourne at the Monash University Museum of Art. It's not just paintings, there's a display case featuring his infamous T-shirts, a gold bikini and a budgie smuggler, and some of his kangaroo fur bling. They've all been props in his three films, Us vs. Them, Broken English, and the cringeworthy Scratch an Aussie, where Richard plays an Aboriginal Sigmund Freud, psychoanalysing blonde models on a leather couch. But instead of stream of consciousness, it's a stream of racist jokes. And Richard ends up on the couch himself with Dr. Gary Foley as the psychoanalyst.
I don't actually want to see him get better. I want him to keep coming back and give me more money, so I can buy some land back, seeing they won't give it to me.
It belongs to me.
No.
Yes.
No, it belongs to me.
So you see them as people you can exploit?
Damn right.
And deprive of their rights and property and land?
Yeah, and that's what bothers me. But I can do it so easily.
Another of the really important works over here, thank Christ. Is it Uppity Schoolgirl, this one?
Yes. Yeah, this is the image is an appropriation of a Roy Lichtenstein work. It's got this pretty young woman throwing her head back in laughter, you know, and so I've got her saying, thank Christ I don't live on Palm Island. So in this version of that work.
Palm Island, the death on Palm Island of Murrunji, Dumuji, and it really galvanised you and the rest of Proper Now.
Palm Island is a Queensland thing, you know, Queensland blackfellow thing, yeah, you know, because basically it was a gulag, you know, for dissidents, you know, from other Aboriginal reserves, you know, they're often sent there as punishment for, you know, political activities. And so we all have relatives on Palm Island, so that's why it's so important to us. And that case is so important because, you know, if that guy gets away with it, and to now he has. That means that every single one of us fear for the lives of any of our loved ones who are taken into custody by the police. That's a horrible, horrible thought, to think that you don't know whether you will see that person alive again once they've been arrested by the police.
We're in the room with your epic collaboration with Emery Douglas.
Yeah. Yeah, epic is a good word. It's like 15 metres by 3 metres high. You know? So it's quite a big work. And here they've got it wrapped around a corner. So it's otherwise they haven't got a wall long enough to hold the thing.
For those people who don't know, who is Emery Douglas?
Emery Douglas is an American artist who was the Minister for Culture in the Black Panther Party in America in the late 60s to the early 80s. So quite a significant player in that organisation, and this is something that Emery and I did in, I think it was 2010. No, it was 2011. It was at the same time as the floods in Brisbane. We came up with the concept, and we did it in 6 days. We've collaborated quite a few times now.
I don't need a tax cut. I want my whole country back.
He's going down. He's going down.
You know, the trouble with this work over here, something a little bit bit different, can I say?
Yeah. Well, this is. I've got some placards to go with this.
It is a work, isn't it?
Yes, it is. This is a. This is. There'll be some signs and placards. This is a recreation of the first Aboriginal embassy, which was a beach umbrella, a much more upmarket beach umbrella than what the brothers had in 1972. Much better chairs and that sort of thing. So what I've done is I've sort of recreated the signs and the handwriting of the guys as they did them back then. So.
And it's very comfortable. You've got a bit of AstroTurf, you've got umbrella, you've got a esky over there, and you've got two banana lounges and a couple of swags.
Yeah. Well, this is comfort. You know, like, lots of people like sleeping under the stars. You know, like, well, if I'm going to sleep under the stars, I want it to be four or five stars. There was this artist from the Central Desert, you know, who said, if I don't paint my story, someone will steal my land. So I changed what he said. I said, if I don't paint my story, someone will get away with stealing my land. So it's just a play on that. And then down the left-hand side, there's all these names of people who have, mainly anthropologists, I think, and assorted bints, you know, like a bint being, you know, like somebody who's been in the Northern Territory. These people are experts on Aboriginal people. So the government doesn't need to talk to Aboriginal people about Aboriginal issues. These are the people they go to. These are their go-to guys.
And there are Aboriginal people in the list?
There's a couple there, I think. A couple of assimilations, you know. So.
And in the way that you've, I guess, rephrased that statement, what are you trying to say? Is it about power and or just what?
No, it's about justifying, you know, what I do. You know, like... I'm telling our stories and I'm legitimising our stories on, as being just as important as from any other part of the country.
And when you say our, you mean people from the south, from the eastern...
From the more closely settled areas. You know, the centre will be just as colonised as us in 100 years' time. Make no doubt about it. You know, most of them people will be fair-skinned, like our people, you know, in 100 years' time. There's a prediction, you know, like that nobody is going to argue with.
Because
you
did say to me when I saw you last year, the youth. You said that the biggest issue for us was who is an Aborigine, and yes. how we decide. Who is and who isn't?
Yes, that is in almost every community. That's the discussion on everybody's lips. You know, like what is an Aboriginal? You know, like who is an Aboriginal? You know, we're looking at people. We're being encouraged to look at people. You know, like in a very white way. You know, like in that we're just looking at appearances. Instead of looking at the content, you know, we need to look at this long and hard, I think, you know, like, not take it lightly at all. I think we need to allocate time to discussing this, you know, so that we know what it is we're moving forward with, you know, like, and who is going to be moving forward with us, you know? For me, you know, like, I like self identification. You know, like if there's white people out there who, you know, like who want to identify as being black fellows, cool. But you know, like just say, okay, well, if you want to be Aboriginal, live in an Aboriginal community. You know, like because we say often it's not about skin colour. You know, like it's about you know, our belief systems and as well. You know, like as that. So I'm more inclusive than most of, I think, on this issue. You know, a lot of people say blah blah blah, you know, but damn. Nothing's black or white. That's one of the things, you know, about Out to Dry, that the first work that we looked at. It was talking about those things. You know, like it's, you know, it's about whether you know more than 50 cousins. You know, like every black fellow I know knows more than 50 of their cousins. You know. So, you know, things like that. Those sorts of things. Like our passport is the story of our family, you know, who our family is, you know, like where they come from, and these sorts of things. You know, that's our identity, you know, right there. It's, you know, we've got a 30-second version, a 1-minute 30-second version, a 2.5-minute, you know, version, a 1-hour version. You know, we could talk about it for days. Actually, I've been asked by the Australia Council to get a certificate, you know, saying that I'm Aboriginal. Yeah?
Recently,
yes. You know, I withdrew my application because they required me to give a certificate, you know, of Aboriginality. You know? That's a requirement. The Australian government won't give me via the Australia Council won't give me a fellowship unless I furnish a certificate of Aboriginality, which can only be given by a government-approved organisation. Like Proper Now cannot give out a certificate. It isn't a statutory declaration from me stating that I'm Aboriginal. Isn't that enough? You know, like that's enough for every other citizen in Australia. You know, like to write a declaration, you know, and get it sworn before a justice of the peace, you know, and if you lie under those things, you can be in prison. You know, so I'm prepared to go to do that, you know, like to face prison if somebody can prove that I'm not Aboriginal.
But you could easily obtain a certificate of Aboriginality.
Well, it's not that easy. You've got to actually go to an Aboriginal organisation. You have to ask them to raise it at a meeting, you know, and then there has to be, you know, somebody has to move the motion saying that we acknowledge that so-and-so is Aboriginal, blah, blah, blah.
And a lot of people have been hurt by that process.
Yes,
a lot of people that we accept as Aboriginal.
Yes, yeah, you know, like people who are obviously Aboriginal, you know, like haven't been able to get a certificate of Aboriginality because these people don't know them, or B, they don't like them. What is that? Yeah.
Richard, thank you so much for walking me around this exhibition. And it's so great that you know, people in Melbourne are going to see this work in the context that it needs to be seen in, as part of a long story.
Yeah, well it's good to come down here and show in Melbourne. I think this is the first time a member of Proper Now has actually, you know, shown here in Melbourne. Yeah.
In a solo exhibition
in an institution.
I'm really surprised. I'm really surprised by that.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Well, maybe you know, it's more backward than people realise.
Richard Bell. Thank you so much.
No problem, mate.
We're on your land.
Sam, we're on Aboriginal land. You're like, don't you think that they should give this back to us people, us black fellas? That's it. Richard's going to do a land claim on GoPro.
Check.
from his film Broken English, Richard Bell. And his survey exhibition Lessons on Etiquette and Manners is on at the Monash University Museum of Art in Melbourne until the 13th of April. It's co-curated by Max Delaney and Francis E. Parker. And you can catch Richard in conversation with Gary Foley next Friday, that's the 15th of March, at the Wheeler Centre, and I'll be chairing the discussion. More details on our website, abc.net.au/radionational. And just find Away in the program menu on the right-hand side of the page. This is Away, 21 years on air here on RN, and you're with me, Daniel Browning. There's strong evidence that music education can be a pathway to other forms of learning. And it's with that in mind that the Melbourne-based Music Outback Foundation has been delivering workshops in remote communities in the Northern Territory, the far north of South Australia, the APY lands, and in Western New South Wales. So far, the Music Outback Foundation has visited 30 communities covering an area of over 350,000 square kilometres. Workshops are delivered as intensive week-long programs each school term. And in each region, the workshops lead to what they call a mob fest. It's a celebration of music. Away's Rico Adrin spoke with mob fest manager Leah Pa'apa and Music Outback Foundation's general manager David Melzer. But first, we're going to hear from founding director and current board member, Steve Berry.
Just through happenstance, I got an opportunity to go and do a workshop on a remote community in Central Australia, a little place called Mbungara, just a tiny place. There were probably three or four families that lived there in a very small government school, one teacher school, about 10 kids in the school. And I got to go there for a couple of weeks just to run some music workshops and see what happened. And it was a life-changing experience. I'd never been to a remote community before. And, you know, I saw, even though I'd lived in Australia for 40 years old and lived in Australia most of my life, I just had no idea that we had a country within a country here. And it felt like I should have had a passport, really, to go there. The language was different. The culture was different. And not just at any superficial level, it was very much like another part of the world. And I have traveled in, you know, remote parts of the world before, and I just couldn't believe that this was Australia. But it was a wonderful experience for me. The kids and the community, you know, through the kids, their parents and grandparents, all immediately engaged with me through the music that I was doing. And it just felt like this was something that really needed to keep going. The school was buzzing because there was so much enthusiasm about the music, and it was a great vision of that principal who that single teacher principal who didn't have music skills himself to realize that getting music in the school would be a good thing to do.
I am David Melzer, the manager of Music Outback. If you look at remote schools, they're the ones that are most disadvantaged, and unfortunately, it seems like things that we work with, music education, are being withdrawn from those schools that need them most.
Has the work so far that UMOB done reaped rewards? Were you seeing change at all up until this point?
The outcomes have been really impressive. Some of our musicians have shown a really long-term commitment to schools and communities and been working in those communities for 10 years. And so the communities and the schools and the kids have really embraced those people, and they've formed strong relationships. And for 10 years, they've worked with Indigenous students to develop their skills, their self-esteem, use of language, and seeing the kids grow up, seeing the kids increase their engagement with the education process, seeing the kids grow into skilled individuals, and worked with those kids over a decade so that the outcomes have been really good, really rewarding for the musicians involved and really rewarding for the kids involved.
My name's Leah Pa'apa'a. I am the event director of the Mobfest events for Music Outback. the school programs and Mobfest have really become part of the, you know, the scene of these communities, that it's really kind of integrated, and where Music Outback has been working for 10 years, it's on the calendar and it's part of the community.
In the street, kicking a beat on my way to the court. Oh yeah, that's me. Got a ball in my hand, cause that's the plan. Not a worry in the world, do you understand? Always up for a challenge, all around talent. Born with light feet, gotta keep my balance. Like Mike, you can battle Tyson. Set like the sun on a gold horizon.
Leah, how and why did you get involved with Music Outback Foundation?
Initially, my sister's one of the long-term artists that has been going out to a community called Laramba in the Northern Territory. So I'd heard about the work and the relationships that she had been developing over 8 years there. And when they did Music Outback receive funding, they were looking for someone with an education background, and my background's in Indigenous education specifically. So it was a really exciting opportunity for me to use some of the things that I had been learning about and implementing in a urban sense, working and living in Melbourne with the community down here, into a remote context, and found so many similarities and so many, I guess, differences as well. So really bringing on the educational side and the community engagement side to what had been delivered primarily by musicians, and have been able to kind of, over the last few years, I've had a few different hats now within the organisation, but being able to kind of help build on the richness of what these programs are. Like, absolutely, they are songwriting and music literacy and education, but there is this whole community and cultural significance and side of what we do that has so much potential to be developed and evolve.
Tell us about the role of facilitators, like how you came to incorporate them and how important they are.
Well, they're the heart of the organisation, the heart of the work, really. And the musicians that I chose in those early days, you know, just friends, really, people who I knew, who I just knew that they would have an aptitude for that sort of thing. And interestingly enough, the festivals that I've worked, sort of the contemporary folk festivals around the country, places like Mullaney Woodford Folk Festival and the arts festivals, the people who move in those circles are very flexible and intuitive and able to kind of move with the moment, good improvisers, which is all qualities that you need when you're working in that context, because often things aren't as you would have expected them to be when you get there. If something is different, kids aren't there that you expected to be there, or you've got more kids than you expected, or just there could be any number of things going on. Yep. And there have been, believe me. It's very important for people to be able to adjust and yet still have that kind of those goals and those target outcomes in mind and be able to get there through another pathway. So the people I chose were really all about having that aptitude.
Walking the streets, kicking to the beat. Got the snare in my head, to the sound of my feet. I tap the table to the sound of the drums. I burn these beats like a CD-ROM. Lived all my life without the strife. These beats are so sharp, they cut like a knife. Got Duke right here, busting all these rhymes. We pass the mic, just to pass the time.
In the time that you've been with MOF, Leah, can you give us a ballpark figure as to the number of kilometres you've travelled in aid of enhancing educational outcomes for remote community youth?
I recently was out in going in between the Pitjantjatjara lands in South Australia and Tea Tree, which is in the Northern Territory, and just in my month there of consultations, I clocked up 5,000 kilometres on the odometer. And that was just one trip. So it's been a lot, and that's not including the flights. You know, I recognise that we fly over many Indigenous nations to get out to these communities, and, you know, this work's needed all over the place, really. And you know, there's so much work and, you know, we're a small organisation and we're operating out of Melbourne, but the potential, you know, we see the kids light up, you know, when I was in Ernabella recently, or Pukacha, you know, liaising with community and go down to the general store and people started calling me Mobfest. So that was my name while I was in community. Hey, Mobfest, what you doing, Mobfest? And, you know, just the kids recognise who we are now and you know, are expecting us to come and looking forward to that. And that's, you know, that's really exciting and a really beautiful experience for us to be able to be out there.
Speaking of Mobfest, Dave, with the number of fronts in which MOF is taking on educational opportunities, touch on Mobfest and what it adds to the existing programs on your roster.
It's a fantastic opportunity for communities to see their young people performing and demonstrating, showcasing their skills. And it does do a lot for the kids' self-esteem, but it also, you see the elders sitting there with some pride seeing the people from their community acquiring skills through the process. It's really nice.
And we're kicking back, but there's nothing else to do. And we're kicking back,
kicking, chilling, dreaming,
like it's Friday afternoon.
Walking the streets, kicking a beat, no cares, no worries, ah, yeah, that's me. I'm coming from the heart, if you know what I mean. Just kick back, relax, like you're living the dream. Cause behind the scenes, it ain't what it seems. Turn to God when life gets mean. Life or death, what's in between? I don't really know, but I'm keen to see.
And we're kicking back, so
what we gonna do?
What we gonna do?
Yeah, but there's nothing else to do.
Dreaming.
From day one, what were Music Outback Foundation's main principles and have they changed at all?
Continuity, I would say, would be the biggest thing. Long-term, meaningful relationships that should be formed between the facilitators and the kids, obviously, but also the school teachers and, very, very importantly, the community members themselves. So where we've been going the longest, we've got very strong relationships through the kids right to the parents and grandparents, and really they've described us in absolute terms as their own true sons and daughters, as actual family to them, because we keep coming back and we keep working with them to deliver what they want for their kids, which is as much about arts and music as it's as also as much about the opportunities for their own culture to be included. And that is another side of the coin that has been a very important principle for us, is to act as a platform where community, local, indigenous culture can be expressed as part of the work we do through the participation of community adults and elders. They're part of our team at an absolute core level, and then also during the year when we're writing songs with the kids in our regular workshops that happen during the school year, as much as possible the community elders get involved. So it gives an opportunity for parents to be involved in a structured program out of school, which often you don't see out on remote communities. There can be an isolation that occurs between schools in a community and the community themselves, and It's very clear to anyone who's out there that getting the community and teachers, community elders engaged with the schools, working with the kids, part of that whole system of learning is a very important part of having success out there in education. Yeah, in fact, they outline principles themselves. There was a remote conference that happened in 2003 that I took part in where all the indigenous education workers came into Alice Springs and came up with five principles that were very important to them in terms of the criteria that remote education should be delivered under. Yep. And what those were in local language and culture, supporting literacy and numeracy, building relationships with community, engaging indigenous staff, and meaningful, relevant learning to the kids. In other words, local content, local cultural content, So I recognize that the music work that we were doing already engaged those principles, and we simply then were able to expand on that and always make sure that that remained a part of what we did.
Is there scientific evidence in regards to the advantage in music education?
Yeah, there's just been some recent studies by the Australian Council of Education Research showing how music education can improve, at a very basic level, kids' engagement with schools, also their attendance at schools, their self-esteem, and then building on that, numeracy and literacy, and you touch on a really significant and central point to the whole program. And there are a couple of other organisations that try to do similar things. But when we talk to schools about doing music education in their schools, a lot of these schools in remote communities are under a lot of pressure to improve numeracy and literacy, with the whole focus on getting students job ready by the time they finish schools. They say, oh, if you take our kids away for an hour, that's an hour less that we've got with them doing literacy and numeracy stuff. There's a lot of research which shows that music education and general arts education gives kids the self-esteem, the engagement with the educational process that will lead to improvement in numeracy and literacy. And that's not to mention just the basic writing, reading and numbers work that happens through songwriting process. But we often lose that argument with schools and principals that are really under the pressure to produce better NAPLAN results each year. So it's an interesting issue, and it's one ongoing debate. But like you say, there is hard-edged evidence to show that music education improves educational outcomes.
Tell us how engaged a community becomes when you arrive in a remote area.
They become incredibly involved, you know, and it takes time, and it's always about relationships and being on the ground and always coming back is really important. We recognise that we come back, you know, we keep flying in, and that has allowed us to really, you know, to develop those solid relationships. And we're at a point now where even if it's not at Tea Tree, even if it's not someone from the previous year, just by being known that you're with Music Outback, the elders automatically welcome you in because you know you're with that mob. And that's really significant for us as far as continuing and developing and growing the relationships. And I think, you know, Mobfest has become not only its own kind of festival and celebration of all that the kids do and the community does, but it's become a really positive engagement point for the community and for the parents into the schools. And a lot of times, you know, even in Melbourne, the only time parents come up is when they're called to the principal's office because their kids have been naughty, yeah, or, you know, picking their kids up or dropping their kids off from school. So all of a sudden we have this time where there's elders and parents engaged and teaching at the school and delivering their culture to the school and feeling valued within, you know, what is really a Western construct that they haven't necessarily been through themselves or understand particularly well. So I think, you know, not only is it culturally, but it's also as far as educational outcomes, you know, it's very similar to that PACE, you know, parent and community engagement program that happens all over the place. It's like we're engaging parents and community into positive positive experiences within the school year, and that has a huge significance, I think.
Coming home.
Please share your thoughts in regards to looking back at the establishment of the foundation and the work done thus far.
Well, when I look back at the last 10 years. It's been a real journey. It's had some unexpected turns for me. For instance, it was always something I expected to be doing on the side. As I mentioned, I've been a musician all my life and been a performer around festivals around Australia. And so I've seen myself as part of a fraternity of musicians and artists that have been doing this work. It's kind of taken over. Music Outback has kind of taken over for me because as it grew. And so on a personal level, that's something that needs addressing. I think it's important to maintain your practice as an artist in order to be able to be a good educator in the arts. So on a personal level, I'm working that way. But also there's so many ways that you can look at this. What's happened over the last 10 years, I see that the numbers of people that have come together to do this work and have made a lifelong commitment to engage with Indigenous Australia through the skills that they have as musicians and artists, whether it be with Music Outback or independently. I feel very honoured to have been to have played a role in helping people make connections with remote Australia and Indigenous Australia that way. As I said, it's something that it took me 40 years of being an Australian to achieve myself. And I think that's a common story for us mainstream Western people who live on the coast. We don't really have many opportunities to make these connections. But when you do, you form real deep, meaningful friendships, family connections that are people that you're going to know all your lives and all their lives. And it's through that connection that good things will happen. It's through the sharing that happens with friends that good things happen. And so I do feel honored to have been part of that development, to be part of the front that actually sees more and more people connecting with remote Australia. I actually counted them up the other day, and there's probably over 150 people that just in the last 10 years have been involved through Music Outback. Many of them previously not having had those opportunities. So I think that's an important thing, and it's a lesson I think could be applied in many other areas of life in Australia, of Australian life, if people actually found a way to make a connection with Indigenous Australia and then just did what they do, sharing their knowledge both ways through those connections. I think we'll see great improvements in health outcomes, great improvements in education outcomes, and we as white fellas on the coast or wherever we live also will benefit greatly from the wonderful rich cultural knowledge that we can just tap into. We're all living on the same continent here, and I think it's very important that those connections are strengthened.
The founding director and current board member of Music Outback Foundation, Steve Berry. You also heard from the foundation's general manager, David Melzer, and Mobfest manager, Leah Papa. For now, that's our program. Away's co-producer in Darwin is Rico Adrin, and the executive producer in Sydney is Lorena Allam. I'm Daniel Browning here in Melbourne. Join us next Saturday at 6 p.m. and on Tuesday night at 9 for more Indigenous art and culture here on RN. I look forward to your company. Until then, keep safe and bye for now.